This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Quote now at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avogan. This day, late 1898 and early 1899, a really fascinating dynamic is playing out as President McKinley tours the South to drum up support for a resolution to the Spanish-American War. McKinley is mostly trying to win over Southern lawmakers to support the Paris Treaty, and in return, he has to make a number of political and cultural appeals, including planting the seed for how the Civil War would be remembered. In many ways, this was a key moment in which new narratives about the war and the South's role were reframed. And that's kind of how we were tipped off to this story in an email from a listener, David. David wrote what I would say is one of the best listener emails in a long time, and sort of laid out this idea and this context, and we're sort of picking it up and we'll get into it. But David, you know, wrote us and said kind of like you could see this moment as the first embrace of the so-called lost cause narrative, the idea that the South was fighting a virtuous war to preserve their rights and their dignity. And we've talked about that narrative on this show before, but I often feel like it's thought of as something that's really that emerged maybe a little later in the early 1900s. And I, at least, hadn't really seen this connection to the Spanish-American War that David points out. So Let's get into the details of all that. McKinley, the Spanish-American War, the roots of the Lost Cause narrative. Super fascinating. Here, as always, Nicole Hemmer of Vanderbilt and Kelly Carter-Jackson of Wellesley. Hello there.
Hi, Jody.
Hey there.
So let's go sort of thread by thread here. So first, Spanish-American War, then the resolution and what McKinley has to do with Southern lawmakers, and then that sort of how this maybe plants the seeds for this lost cause idea, which, as I said, you know, David lays out might be a sort of theory that he has or sort of a read he has, but, you know, we'll get there. But first, the Spanish-American War, you know, I'll cop for the first time in of many times, I think, this episode to not really having seen this before, but the Spanish-American War is the first time since the Civil War that Northerners and Southerners have to fight side by side. And that is a huge, huge deal.
Yeah, it is really a big deal. I mean, if you think about it, it's also a war in which people who fought for the Confederacy are still alive, right? Like, or largely still alive. You know, if you were in your 20s, you might be in your 50s or 60s. But for the most part, the idea of the Civil War as being something that's still very present in people's lives is very real in this moment. And so having another war in which the United States has to come together and fight for imperialism, basically. But like, it's a really big moment. It's also a moment too where, you know, you have Buffalo soldiers, you have Black soldiers that are fighting, you know, in these troops as well. I mean, it's a lot going on over Cuba and Puerto Rico and the Philippines, and those territories, and Spain really relinquishing its hold on Cuba, Cuba being so significant to slavery, Puerto Rico as well. So there's a lot on the table.
And I think that it's important, you know, Kelly mentioned that it's an imperial war, that it is about nationalism and nationhood and pride and power. And this is our area to lord control over. And the United States has been attacked with the attack on the USS Maine. And so there is this sense that that provides a common ground for a fight for folks who last fought against one another, the Southern soldiers in rebellion against the United States. And so it provides an opportunity to fight under the same flag in this very jingoistic moment.
But did Southerners or Southern, especially Southern lawmakers, holdovers from the Confederate era, did they see it that way? Did they want to go to war for the U.S. as a unified country at this point?
It's a bit of a mixed bag.
Yeah.
Kelly was mentioning, and you could talk more about this, Kelly, but you were mentioning that the relationship was like Cuba and Puerto Rico because mm-hmm. they were so defined through these shared histories of slavery. Like, white enslavers in the southern U.S. had wanted more control over Cuba mm-hmm. and Puerto Rico for a long time because they saw them as part of the future expansion of slavery, a way to bring mm-hmm. more enslaved people into the U.S. And so for some white Southerners, it was like, ugh, why couldn't we have done this like 50 years ago? Yeah. We've wanted to do this for a while.
Yeah, Mississippi in particular. I mean, Mississippi had a strong relationship with Cuba. It was actually providing a lot of more enslaved bodies to go to Cuba to sort of fuel these economic and political relationships. And so, I mean, in some ways, like, you see a lot of these engagements that took place politically and economically during the Civil War sort of having their moment again in the Spanish-American War.
So the war starts to resolve itself. That sounds too passive. The war is resolved, and there's the Treaty of Paris in 1898. By December of 1898, which is really the moment we're talking about here, President McKinley, you know, at least senses enough reluctance among Southern political officials that he needs to do this tour of the South, and he does like a 200 stop tour or something, talking to elected Southern officials. And you know, the most notable one is he goes to the Atlanta Jubilee on December 14th, 1898, and gives this big speech. But you know, he clearly feels this need to have to bring the South along in order to gain political will for signing this treaty and bringing a close to the war. What's his political calculus at this point?
The more support that he can get in the South, the more buy-in that he can get in the South, the more he can really accomplish politically. And I think that the South really becomes this major player in the sense that it's still operating as this block in which he has to be able to get them on board in order to get any of his sort of legislative things through. But like, the South still has this way of thinking that has to be persuaded in order to get them on board.
And it's an uphill battle for McKinley because the Spanish-American War started under Grover Cleveland, mm-hmm. who was a Democrat, and the South is solidly Democratic, or is becoming solidly Democratic by the late 1890s. McKinley is a Republican. And so there's already some hesitance there, but he mm-hmm. needs Southern senators in order to advise and consent on the treaty. If he doesn't get them on board, he doesn't get his treaty.
Yeah. Hey there, Jody here, and I'm excited to tell you that one of our favorite Radiotopia siblings, Ear Hustle, is back with a brand new season. This is their 13th season, and the show just keeps getting better. Now, I don't know if you know, but Ear Hustle is the show about life inside prison, but it is not your typical prison podcast. Co-hosts Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods have recently been spending time at 4 California prisons, and now they have a season's worth of funny, surprising, and unforgettable stories to share. In a recent episode, they were able to visit a groundbreaking prison hospice where they spoke to men who are grappling with the reality of dying inside prison. Also coming up this season are stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells, complicated mom-daughter relationships inside prison, and stories of incarcerated people who wonder whether they've become too comfortable behind bars. These are stories about life on the inside told by those who live it. I'll be listening, and I hope you will too. Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts. And so this is kind of where, you know, this story really starts to accelerate and pull in all these other threads. But by all accounts, McKinley's rhetorical strategy and his political strategy is to still harken back to the Civil War. And he starts to really talk explicitly about the legacy of the Confederacy and the legacy of the war in trying to make this appeal to Southerners. We'll talk about some of the specific concessions he makes, mm-hmm. which I think have huge lasting impact. But rhetorically, what is your sense of what he says? I mean, is he really starting to just like reframe, oh, that war thing that happened, you know, a generation ago? how is he approaching that?
I mean, I think he's approaching the South with a lot of care because he knows that the things that matter to the South the most is this sense of legitimacy, is this sense of legacy and heroism, and the idea that they want to be considered brave, courageous, moral. They don't want to be sort of like demarcated as the losers, right? Yeah. And so part of that heritage for them is having monuments and having burial sites and places that mark their contributions as being even laudable. You know, like when you start talking about how you think about memory and how you think about memorials, that's a way of preserving their ideas. And so I think McKinley is very good at sort of assuring them that this is what he can do, that he can give them honor, if you will.
Right. This idea that they weren't traitors, they were honorable American soldiers who fought bravely and fought well and deserved to be recognized as well, which is a rewriting of history, but it was something that white Southerners desperately wanted. They had been reconstructed back into the country. They had retaken power most places across the South. And now they wanted that kind of stain to be removed from their history. And for much of the late 19th century, like, campaigns were held pointing to the Civil War, this idea of waving the bloody shirt and pointing back to the fights and the losses of the Civil War that had defined so much, particularly of presidential politics. And McKinley is basically charting how things are going to move forward and offers a path forward for that in real and tangible ways through monuments, through cemeteries that can...
Blocking out Arlington. Yeah. I mean, like, the fact that Arlington gets, you know, a place for Confederate soldiers, it's astounding to me, right? It's astounding, especially when you're like, wait, do you remember what this war was about? Like, that to me is wild.
Yeah. It's also especially powerful because Arlington Cemetery is built on land from the Lee family. So this is kind of a reclaiming. And then the statues that are put up there are meant to commemorate the South. There are allegories of the South. Mm-hmm. There are all of these equivalent tombstones for Confederate soldiers. So the tombstones will be the same size, except the Union ones, the U.S. soldiers had rounded tops and the Confederate soldiers had pointed tops. There are statues to Confederate women. And so there is this kind of celebration and in some ways almost exoneration of the South and a return in a way of that land, if not to the Lee family, then to Robert E. Lee's cause.
So just to highlight kind of what's happening here, right? It's McKinley is both doing a rhetorical strategy of appeasing and saying the right things when he's in front of Southerners, but then he's really doing political horse trading, I would say, in order to get support for the Paris Treaty. And a lot of that political horse trading, as we've been describing, involves this much, much larger, more fraught and ongoing, and I think really setting this sort of legacy of the story we tell ourselves around the Confederacy and the Civil War. And one of the things that's striking to me about this story is it shows that, like, it has always been about monuments, and it's always been about graves and, you know, physical reminders as much as it is about stories and narratives.
I would say, it's always been about narratives, right? Because the monuments are symbolic of the narrative that you're trying to tell. Yeah. So if you can shape the narrative, then it doesn't matter if you won or lost, because the story is what you want it to be, which is you're still a hero, you're still courageous, you're still American, or however you want to, you know, see yourself. And I think that was one of the most important, and still is in a lot of ways, one of the most important tenets of the Confederacy, is upholding these ideas of their values about what they fought for.
Yeah. What do you make then, Kelly, of this, you know, this idea that's planted in this email, of this being a key moment in which the Lost Cause narrative emerged? Because, I mean, to me, you know, I feel like, obviously this stuff happens over generations, but, you know, to me, I feel like when I've thought about and read about the Lost Cause narrative. I often place it maybe a little later, and I'm like, oh, you know, yeah. Thomas Dixon writes these plays, and we have the Birth of a Nation come out. And this just puts it slightly earlier and puts it in the context yeah. of this political horse trading that McKinley's doing. I mean, do you kind of feel like this is actually a moment in maybe which that Lost Cause narrative is sort of codified in an important way?
Oh, yeah. I agree. I'm like, this is a dissertation. That's another book. I mean, like, when we think about how we shift timelines, timelines are so political, but like, I think there's a lot of credence certainly with this idea that, you know, there is a moment in which perhaps the seeds of the Lost Cause are being planted, or constructed, if you will, with these monuments, and that you get sort of this full bloom moment. And then even again in the, you know, the 1940s and 50s. But I can absolutely give credence to this. Yeah. I mean, and I think part of that is because these people who fought for the Confederacy are still very much alive, and yeah. that this is their sort of last or moment to mark for themselves what they fought for. And then their descendants keep it going. So, you know, in 1915, this is grandfather's story. This is what our grandfathers did, and yada, yada. And it's about preserving that sort of ancestral legacy. But I can definitely see a sound argument that this has legs to it, for sure.
And it also has an important argument for American imperialism, that you're having the yeah. reconsolidation of kind of martial white supremacy mm-hmm. in the Spanish-American War as the U.S. is beginning to take extracontinental territories in places like the Philippines and as a protectorate in Cuba for a while, in Puerto Rico, that there is kind of this consolidation around white supremacy again, which is going to fuel mm-hmm. a lot of this empire, and to kind of rewrite the story of the Civil War makes that a more continuous story in a way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think you get a lot of support because, you know, it's still the suppression of brown people or people of color.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. so people can rally, unfortunately, rally around that as like as another moment in which there's something that they can control.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the other thing this sort of reframing helps me get my head around is just, you know, I think the Lost Cause narrative, it's easy to say like, well, that was something that was born out of the Southern imagination. It was something that Southerners were invested in. And it's a story the South told about itself that then spread and sort of gained traction. And I think this shows that in as many ways, it was the North and Northern, you know, Northerners made choices to sort of be midwives for that theory and that idea.
Yeah.
And I think this is clear, like what McKinley's doing is making a calculus that then creates oxygen for this to emerge.
And I don't think anyone could have anticipated, perhaps maybe least of all McKinley, that like that these statues or that these this iconography would have this kind of power. I think that they probably thought, well, this is minor. Sure, you want a plaque? Yeah. Here, sure, take a plaque, right?
But you don't think carving out space at Arlington Cemetery meant something then in the way that we know that it means something now?
I don't think they thought it would be as I don't think they thought it was as big as a concession yeah. as we see it now.
Yeah.
I think if you had asked people closer to the moment of the Civil War, especially for among, you know, Union soldiers who are still alive, they're like, what? Why are we doing this? But the more distance you get, the less resistance I think you get about certain things.
Right. Yeah. Until you get to, you know, 2020, right? When all this stuff comes back. And I mean, again, I think it helps reframe sort of some of the things we saw there that like these statues matter and they came about for a specific reason and they need to be, you know, talked about, you know, in a specific way and in a sort of concerted way. And, obviously, that there's still a section of Arlington devoted to Confederate graves, and that statue that we described still stands, the valiant Southern woman and the brave Southern men willing to go off to war, though an independent commission has recommended the removal of that memorial at Arlington, and we'll see. Clearly, this connects.
And I also think it completes, and maybe this is redrawing timelines too, but sort of completes Plessy versus Ferguson. Like when you think about 1896 and this separate but equal Supreme Court case that really codifies a lot of the laws that get generated in the South, this is sort of the cherry on top for all of that in terms of thinking about white supremacy socially, legally, politically, economically, so forth.
Yeah.
Intellectually.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of the episode. Super fascinating. And David, who wrote in, you heard it from Kelly. This could be a dissertation. So I don't know what stage you're at in your life. I don't know what else you got going on. But if you want to
tell us where you are,
go down that path. You know, if you got nothing to do for the next, what, 6 to 8 years of your life, yeah, and you want to get a PhD built around this idea, go for it. You know, that's not.
Yeah.
Just don't come to us for the to help with the student debt. Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you as always.
Thank you, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. Our transcripts, which you can find on our website, are done by Kala Nakua. This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, creator-owned, listener-supported podcasts. Audrey Mardovich, executive producer, Yuri Lasordo, director of operations. Thanks to all of you who support this show by being members of Radiotopia. Find transcripts, sign up for our newsletter, find us on social, suggest topics, all that and more at our website, thisdaypod.com. See you soon. Support for This Day in Esoteric Political History comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software or just want to know what you could be missing, then you'll need to join the millions of others who have switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/thisday. That's odoo.com/thisday. Odoo, modern management made simple. Radiotopia.